Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, and I'm here to tell you about a really special event coming up in just a few weeks. We're going to have our 100th podcast episode, and we're doing it live, in person, with a studio audience. Everything will be live. We'll even be streaming it on the web live, so you can actually pull it up and listen to it as we do it. Yes, yeah, see how many flubs we actually make behind the scenes, and this time you'll get to see it live. That's going to be on November the 28th. Right now it's scheduled for 10:30 in the morning on November the 28th. There'll be more details coming about the website and where you can find it, and you'll be the first to know. So join us on November the 28th as we celebrate our 100th podcast. Thanks in large part to all of you that have been listening. Thanks, and we'll see you on November the 28th.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you've taken the time to download us and you're listening. We every week have interesting individuals in the world of exercise science, and we work to bring their science to you. And today is no exception to that. We've got Dr. Sam Chevronk from United States Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine. It's in Natick, Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
More than happy to have you. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. Dr. Chevronk got his PhD from Florida State. He's a registered dietitian and a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine. He has studied hundreds of soldiers and has helped create the official military doctrine of how much soldiers need to eat and drink to prevent dehydration and heat stress. And he's been involved in several other seminal documents about hydration assessment of athletes. And so we're really pleased to have you on so we can talk about hydration issues today.
My pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
Tell me, why are we interested in this in soldiers?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know about us here in Natick, Massachusetts. The USARIM, which is our acronym, the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine, you know, one of our missions is to protect and sustain the health of the warfighter. And, you know, seminal research around the World War II era done by Adolph and Associates determined that, in fact, you know, soldiers can put themselves in situations, much the way we think about athletes performing extreme sports, where they are expending lots of energy, they're losing lots of fluid, under conditions or in situations in which they are unable to replace those calories or replace those liquids. Mm. And so the doctrine that we produce is guidance for training and also for operational needs so that soldiers can sustain their health and performance under those adverse conditions.
Well, it's interesting you say that because probably most of the listeners are aware that hydration is a really important thing for athletes, and I bet that most of them haven't thought about that as it applies to soldiers.
Yeah, you're probably right about that, and yet you know, what we ask of our soldiers is far more extreme in most cases than what even some of the most extreme athletes endure.
Yeah. What are some of the environments that you have tested soldiers in particular to some of the conflicts that we've been dealing with recently?
So the area that I work in, I'm in the Thermal and Mountain Medicine Division at USARIM, and we study heat, cold, high altitude, and, of course, the hydration contingent of all three of those. So the area I work in principally is heat, and so the environments that we typically use in our studies range from what we'll call warm, which is about 86 degrees Fahrenheit, to hot, which we usually typically test up to about 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's hot.
It is, and we typically test dry environments because a lot of the conflicts that we're in and have been in for the last several decades have been hot, dry environments, but we also have the ability and do also study hot, humid heat as well.
Right. Now, when you test these soldiers, it's not just the heat, but also you look at effective uniforms and packs and so forth, right?
Oh, that's correct. So we collaborate with other divisions and also other organizations on our installation that produce new clothing ensembles for the soldier, and we help to test those to see if, in fact, they increase or decrease the thermal burden while providing some other form of protection. A good example of that is when interceptor body armor was introduced. Interceptor body armor is fantastic in that it really does protect the soldier's torso and helps to save lives. It does also, however, produce an added thermal burden, and it's worn in an environment in which you don't want any added thermal burden. So by testing that and then also testing cooling strategies that we can adopt to help reduce that burden, we help to, again, protect and sustain the soldier.
Interesting. So, yeah, and again, that's probably something that people don't think about, is that with all the equipment that the soldiers carry, that you also have to consider how much more burden that provides onto the thermal regulatory system. So you guys, I'm sure, play a big role in the designing of uniforms and their battle gear.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's part of our mission.
Yeah. So you're the expert in this. You're helping us maintain our soldiers' health and their welfare. So if anybody knows the answer to the questions about sweating and exercise, it would be you. So how much water should we drink to compensate for sweat during exercise?
So whether we're talking about athletes, the kind we typically think about, or we're talking about the soldier athlete is what I'll call them in this case.
Okay.
You know, the American College of Sports Medicine produced a position stand on fluid replacement in 2007 to update their 1996 position stand. And, you know, there are a number of different fluid intake guidelines produced by different organizations for athletes in particular. And this includes a recreational to presumably the elite athlete, although the elite athlete is not studied very often. And the recommendation there when it comes to activity is to drink and is to individualize fluid intake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds pretty vague, maybe even a cop-out in some cases, because people want a hard, fast number. But the problem is that there's a lot of normal variation in how much fluid people lose, and therefore there's going to be a lot of normal variation in how much fluid we recommend people drink.
So it's almost going to be customized for the individual, huh?
That's exactly right. It's a great way of putting it. And that customization involves drinking enough, knowing one's sweating rate or knowing one's rate of water loss, to prevent excessive dehydration. And we usually draw that line in the sand at about a 2% loss of body mass from body water,
mm-hmm.
which for a person who weighs about 150 pounds, that's about 1.5 liters of sweat.
Mm. Okay. So that sounds difficult to do.
It may sound that way, but you know, sweating rates really they do depend on body size. They depend on exercise intensity. They depend on environment. They depend on clothing. Lots of things that add to that variability I mentioned earlier. And it's not impossible for people to sweat 0.5 liter per hour very easily. It's not impossible for people to sweat over 2 liters per hour. So that 2% level of dehydration in the absence of fluid intake can occur certainly within an hour of exercise and most definitely within an hour and a half.
So is it a really good guide for people is to weigh themselves? Is that what you would advocate for?
Right. So that what we recommend is under controlled situations, to the extent that one can control this on their own outside of a laboratory, is to simply weigh oneself with minimal clothing or nude in the privacy. Perform the exercise that you normally do, refrain from drinking,
mm-hmm.
and that way you weigh yourself again after exercise, again semi-clothed or nude, and the change in your body mass is principally the result of water loss.
Okay.
Just take that change in mass and divide by time, you can calculate a sweating rate very easily.
Yeah. And you can use that then to set up your how much fluid you should be taking in.
Right. And that'll, again, depend because, you know, if you're going to run, say, a 10K on a weekend and you're going to do it in, say, you know, 1 hour, which is a pretty recreational but reasonable time, chances are good that even if it's a pretty warm day, there just isn't going to be enough time for you to develop that level of dehydration we mentioned earlier. And so drinking isn't that much of a concern as long as you start out well hydrated.
Yeah.
However, if you're the person, you know, running for 90 minutes or exercising for 90 minutes at a time or 2 hours at a time, or certainly if you're, you know, training for a marathon or something like that, then in fact there's plenty of time for you to develop a substantial fluid deficit, and so you're going to need to pay attention to your fluid intake in those situations.
Following up on that, should an individual who has exercised for only 30 minutes worry about electrolyte loss or dehydration?
As long as that person maintains their nutrition and hydration day to day, and they know that they begin the exercise bout in a well-hydrated state, then, no, there really isn't any reason to worry about water or electrolyte losses in a 30-minute time period.
Okay. But more than that, we certainly need to think about hydration.
Right, right. And the other thing that people often miss is that, you know, if you're the average person, I'll say the average person exercising, say, 3 to 5 days a week for 30 minutes a day, or you follow the ACSM recommendations of 20 to 30 minutes of continuous activity or so on a daily basis, there's plenty of time throughout the day for you to eat and drink all the fluid you like. That means you're going to get plenty of electrolytes in the variety of food choices that you make and plenty of fluid. And what we find is that even the people who exercise a lot more than that, on a day-to-day basis, they seem to self-regulate and maintain hydration status pretty well.
I've always kind of heard an old rule of thumb is that if you're going to go out and exercise for more than an hour, you should think about drinking sports drinks as opposed to water.
Right.
Would you buy into that?
Right, so there are certainly known benefits of consuming sports. For one, they're flavored.
Mm-hmm.
Research shows that people will tend to consume more of a flavored beverage than they will of something that's unflavored like water. Drinks are also formulated specifically to contain a small amount of sugar and also electrolytes. And the benefits of those things, in part, again, are for flavor. But also, if you're going to be exercising intensely or you're a competitive athlete exercising for more than an hour, then there are some documented benefits of consuming beverages like that for those particular kinds of tasks. Replacing the carbohydrate that you've used during exercise, replacing the electrolytes that you've lost in sweat, sports drinks also allow you to get a head start on that.
Right.
But again, as long as you have ample access to food and fluid, that's not usually a big concern. That's a different situation, by the way, than what many of our soldiers face. They have limited access to food and fluid, or times in which they can consume that food and fluid. And so things like that become a little bit more important in their situation.
Right. So we're entering, many of us are entering the fall and winter season. Does cold weather, cold exposure have any, does that affect any of this stuff?
Yes, well, you know, what people often think is that because it's cold outside, then maybe they're not going to sweat.
Right.
And it makes perfect sense, and if we study this in a laboratory, we know that sweating rate declines very much in a cold environment, and that's because more heat that's generated during exercise of the same intensity is lost by, we say, radiation and convection or dry heat exchange. That just means that the air and the air movement around you is much cooler than your skin, and so you're able to lose heat that way without producing sweat, which cools us by evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
But when we exercise outdoors in the winter, we typically wear much more clothing.
Right.
And so when you're generating plenty of heat and you're wearing lots of clothing, you can actually still incur some substantial sweat losses during exercise and cold activity. So, again, the recommendation becomes to pay attention to what you're losing so that you can replace that.
Interesting. Now is our concern with dehydration, should that be more specifically towards some individuals, maybe different gender or age? Are there other mitigating factors that may increase the risk of dehydration?
Certainly, the very young and the very old are probably less resilient to the effects of dehydration. And in particular, in the very young pediatric population, they can become very dehydrated very quickly. Now, what you and I have been talking about is dehydration with a sports orientation. So.
Right. Right.
We're doing this on purpose. We're producing metabolic heat that makes us sweat and lose body water. We can also dehydrate when we're ill. For example, when we have gastrointestinal illness, diarrhea, vomiting, or during heat waves in which, say, a feeble older person is not able to help themselves and to get access to fluid. So under those conditions, you know, we have another concern, and that's really where the medical community provide statistics on hospitalizations and treatments for dehydration. And we also see that in the military because there are over 9,000 emergency room visits from fluid and electrolyte imbalances during military training, and about 120 hospitalizations per year. That means they not only see the emergency room, but they stay at the hospital for treatment. So it can be a significant problem, whether the dehydration is due to illness or it's due to activity.
Mm. So you guys, and we mentioned this earlier, but you provide guidance documentation for things like basic training.
Correct.
To try to knock down those hospital visits for dehydration in those recruits.
That's right. So we produced that doctrine, which is guidance, and we also work on developing devices that, for example, assist in the assessment of hydration status, so that time soldiers can know what they're losing and whether or not they're maintaining hydration. And we also need to keep in mind that what we produce in terms of doctrine for training, oftentimes training has to be done outside the conditions in which that doctrine was generated, operational type situations. So that's why more and more, you know, we're looking at the sophisticated models for predicting water losses and water needs and being able to use those in real time, sort of in a phone app type of situation.
Yeah. One of the things that we've had the honor to do is to interview some Army generals on this podcast in the past, and one of the things that has been brought up is the general low level of fitness that many of the recruits have coming into the service now. With that low level of fitness, is that influencing or increasing the rate of dehydration that you guys are seeing, or is that not a problem?
So we don't have, or I am not aware of good statistics that delineate the fitness component to the fluid electrolyte imbalances and what that means in terms of the medical surveillance monthly reports. But, you know, when you have low fitness, what we know is that you are more susceptible to both moderate and severe heat illness. And dehydration is a contributing factor to heat illness, more specifically to heat exhaustion, which is a kind of collapse in the heat that resolves on its own with fluid intake and rest and recovery. I suspect that with low fitness, you'll see more of that, but both dependent and independent of hydration, though.
Yeah. I saw you recently give a talk, and it was about the five myths talk. And one of the topics, if I recall correctly, that you talked about was how much water a person should drink in general on a daily basis.
Yes.
Can you quickly give us a summary of what you said? Because I think that there's a lot of myth out there about how much water you should drink on a daily basis.
Sure. So in 2005, the dietary reference intakes for water and electrolytes were published. This is an update to the 1989 RDAs. And there has never been, and nor is there now, a true RDA for water.
Mm.
And the reason for that, which I mentioned in my talk, has to do with this variability. It's very, very difficult, based on the way that an RDA is established, to set something like that for water.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, the recommendation is something called an AI, or an adequate intake, and that's an intake above which or below which that's an intake above which there's little risk of what we'll call classic deficiency, and that has to be defined by the different hydration assessment markers and methods and survey data. So the recommendation, the AI for water, is 3.7 liters per day for men and 2.7 liters per day for women, 20% of which is assumed to come from food.
Mm, okay.
So that really ends up coming out to something like about 3 liters for men and about 2 liters for women.
Mm, okay. And that's considered adequate intake?
That's considered adequate intake.
Yeah. Super. Now, is there a quick and easy way, we're jumping around a little bit, but that's okay, reflecting back on your talk, you gave a quick and easy way people could tell if they were dehydrated other than measuring their weight, and that was through the color of their urine.
Right. So, you know, one of the pioneers in quantifying urine color is Dr. Larry Armstrong at the University of Connecticut, and he produced a urine color chart that can be used for the conditions that you're describing, for the average person who wants to check their hydration status from day to day. And what I outlined in that talk, too, is that there really, even urine color, there really isn't one particular marker that we can recommend that gives you definitive information about your hydration. But there are three common things you can use in combination, and with those in combination, you can get a better idea. And so urine color, the presence of thirst, and a change in body mass are the three things that one can use. And the way we recommend this be done is that you assess your first morning body weight.
Mm-hmm.
And from day to day, what we know, you're maintaining your hydration status, that deviates only by about 1%.
Okay.
And so if you were to do a lot of activity, if you were to, be very busy and not drink very much, and you were to weigh yourself day to day, what you'd find is if, in fact, you were dehydrated, that you would see a mass change or a weight change of greater than 1%. Now, something like that could also occur just due to bile habits. So what we recommend is that while using that, you also look at urine color.
Okay.
Say that anything the color of apple juice or darker is probably an indicator of dehydration. And then we ask that people think about whether or not they feel thirsty. And it's not what I usually like to say is that if you have difficulty forming saliva, that's pretty overt thirst.
Yeah.
Minus a headache, which would also be a pretty good indicator in that case. But again, those things can occur for reasons. So what we recommend is called WHAT. WHAT is the answer to how you do this. It's weight, urine, and thirst, WUT.
Mm-hmm.
And if any two of those things I just described are present, then it's likely that you're not drinking enough.
Yeah.
If all three are present, then it's very likely that you're dehydrated, and a blood test would probably confirm that.
Yeah. Great guidelines. We are unfortunately running out of time, though. So we always give our guests an opportunity to give us a take-home message. What is it that you want people to remember most about this podcast?
Well, I think personally, in light of a lot of the confusion that I hear, questions that I get, confusion based on a lot of the literature that I read, I think one thing I'd like to tip for everyone to take home is that the ACSM fluid intake guidelines are guidelines based on individuals.
Okay.
Individualizing fluid intake. They're not a set volume of fluid. And they require a person to know their sweating rate. And if performance is an issue, something you want to preserve, then replacing water losses so that you prevent dehydration in excess of 2% body mass is really the key there.
Great. Great take-home message. And we hope people remember that. Sam, I'd like to thank you for taking time out today to visit with us and chat with us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, really.
Well, that's great. Hey, we were so glad to have you. And as our regular listeners know, we always wind everything up with a T-shirt question of the week. And so here with our T-shirt question of the week is Kelly.
What acronym is used to determine level of hydration?
Super question. Be the first one to email us the correct response to that. Email it to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. So again, thank you all for downloading us and listening to us this week. Sam, once again, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And I hope that all of you tune in next week when we have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine with us. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer, made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closings are provided by johnmilesproductions.com. Music was provided by David Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.